I wonder how many of you had heroes when you were kids. I mean, think back, go back a decade or two decades or five decades, seven decades. Go back and think about the heroes you had as a kid. I mean, I tried to rack my brain with this one. I think probably my hero was MacGyver. Does anyone know who MacGyver is? All right, great. MacGyver, do you remember him? He was a scientific genius. I mean, he came up with these amazing escape plans by looking underneath the medicine cabinet and mixing together thises and thats. I think TSA made them take that show off the air because he taught people how to make bombs and things like that. But MacGyver, probably one of my childhood heroes. I think probably my dad was one of my childhood heroes, someone that just worked for the Lord. He gave his life in service for Christ and spent himself for other people. I don't know if I had any sports heroes, but I do remember that my neighbor down the street had one. And you couldn't escape this sports hero because when you walked into his bedroom, it was like everything was about this hero. But let me give you some clues. See if you can figure out who his hero was. The colors were black and red. The theme surrounded Chicago. There were hats with autographs on the rim. There were certain shoes, the cool shoes. You know, because when you tight rolled your pants back then, you had to have these certain type of high top shoes. Jerseys on the wall. Some of you are getting it. You're shaking your head. The number 23. Does it ring a bell? Oh, he was a Michael Jordan, Chicago Bulls fanatic. Michael Jordan was his hero. Now, I want to suggest that probably all of us, if we think back hard enough, we had heroes of some sort. And having a hero is not necessarily bad. Quite frankly, the Bible gives us heroes. Did you know that? Heroes of faith. People who served the Lord with their lives. Actually, there's a chapter in the Bible that many scholars, theologians, they refer to it as the Hall of Faith. Kind of like the Hall of Fame, the Hall of Faith. Do you know what that chapter is? Some of you know. It's Hebrews 11. And in Hebrews 11, the writer outlines these different heroes of faith. It's not bad to have heroes, but it is bad to worship heroes. Right? There's a distinction. I mean, there's God and then there's man. And we must not confuse the two. The scriptures record a few accounts in which people tried to worship man. Like Paul, for instance. He's at this particular city. He heals this particular crippled person. The next thing you know, the city's going crazy. They're bringing out garlands and wreaths, and they're putting them over Paul's head. They begin to call him Zeus or Hermes. He's Hermes, and Barnabas is Zeus, and they begin to bow down and worship him. He says, stop, stop, stop. We're people just like you. We must not confuse the two. There's people, and there's God. God gets worship. People don't. So it's okay to have heroes. It's not okay to worship heroes. Real heroes of the faith are people who we follow as they follow Christ. Isn't that what Paul said? He said, follow me as I follow Christ. Heroes of the faith are people who are signposts. Have you ever walked somewhere, maybe you're in a shopping mall or something, and you see someone and they're doing this? You know, I mean, and you're walking, you're looking at, and then pretty soon you're like, you're looking, what are they looking at, right? They're gazing in a certain direction and they're causing you to gaze the same way. So after this long series in Hebrews 11 of these different heroes of faith, Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1 says this, seeing that we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, heroes of the faith, let us, as people inspired by them, let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. So heroes inspire us to look to Jesus. Now, I'm taking time this morning. Some of you are wondering, you're belaboring this point, Lucas. Let us move forward now. I get it. There are people. There is God. We need to worship God and not people. It's okay to have heroes, not worship heroes. I get it. Yes, but I feel like I must do this. Because we're going to look at a particular hero of the faith who has been idolized by some, who has been worshipped inappropriately by some. And that's why I want to make this. Not even angels receive worship. Did you know that? You bow down at Gabriel's feet and Gabriel would say, get up. Don't do that. In the book of Revelation, John, the apostle, he bows down and an angel says, get up. Don't worship me. Only God is to be worshipped. Have heroes, don't worship heroes. Enough, Lucas. Who is the hero we're talking about this morning? My friends, we're going to talk about Jesus' mother. But ultimately, we're going to look to Jesus. So as we study Mary, that's our theme this morning from the text, describes Mary. But as we look at Mary, we're going to walk through her life. We're going to see things that point us to a biblical way of living. But ultimately, we must not let our focus stop with Mary. Mary is not a cul-de-sac. Mary is a signpost, and she points us to Jesus. So, with all that ado, look at Luke chapter 1, verse number 26. Luke 1:26. In the sixth month, the angel Gabriel was sent from God to a city of Galilee named Nazareth. Why does he say all that? Because not everyone who read Luke's gospel would know where Nazareth is. It's a little podunk place that people may not have known. And so he tells us what region it's in. It's in Galilee. This little town is named Nazareth. So Gabriel comes, verse 27, to a virgin betrothed to a man whose name was Joseph. Now, again, I'm going to make commentary, but betrothal back then was part one of marriage. So for the Jewish culture, part one was you get betrothed. It was more significant than our engagement. Some of you understand engagement, you get down on your knee, you give a ring, you pledge, and then you wait. Back then, betrothal was a little more serious because actually you paid a price, a bride price, to the father of the bride. You gave money because he was going to lose a daughter. So you gave him money. It was a public affair, and they were considered bound, although they did not consummate the marriage physically. And normally this waiting time of betrothal would take about a year. The girls, and I call them girls because they were between 13 and 15 when they were betrothed. And after about a year, while the husband made preparation to add a room onto his father's house, while he worked on all of that, then they would have this marriage ceremony about a year later. So when we get to this text, it's telling us that Mary is a virgin who's betrothed to a man named Joseph. He's of the house of David, verse 27. And the virgin's name was Mary. And he came to her and he said, who's the he? It's Gabriel. Gabriel the angel, he came to her and said, greetings, O favored one, the Lord is with you. But she was greatly troubled at the saying. Wouldn't you be? You go home this afternoon. You're cooking lunch in the kitchen. You turn around to put the pot on the stove, and there's this shining angel in your kitchen. Let me tell you, you'd be shocked too. You might be greatly affrighted, as the King James Version says. Greatly affrighted. You'd be trembling. All right, so she's like, what is this being doing here? Greetings, O favored one. The Lord is with you. But she was greatly troubled at the saying. She tried to discern what sort of greeting this might be. Verse 30. The angel said to her, do not be afraid, Mary. You have found favor with God. Now, the word favor has been used two times here. You could put in the margin, the Greek word is charis, meaning grace. You have been graced by God, Mary. That's what Gabriel assures her. Verse 31, behold, you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus. Again, I stop. What is the miracle of the incarnation? It is not a miraculous birth, although we'll all kind of refer to it the miraculous birth of Jesus. Quite frankly, the birth part of it is not the miracle. He was born in the same way that every child is born. It's the conception part of it that's the miracle. And that's why it says in the text in verse number 31, you will conceive in your womb and bear a child. You will call his name Jesus. The conception was going to be miraculous because she was a virgin. Verse 32, he will be great. He will be called Son of the Most High. And the Lord God will give to him the throne of his father David. He will reign over the house of Jacob forever. And of his kingdom, there will be no end. Verse 34. Mary said to the angel, how will this be since I am a virgin? And the angel answered her, the Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. Therefore, the child to be born will be called Holy, the Son of God. And behold, your relative Elizabeth in her old age has also conceived a son. And this is the sixth month with her who is called barren, for nothing will be impossible with God. Underline that phrase. Nothing will be impossible with God. Verse number 38. And Mary said, behold, I am the servant of the Lord. Let it be to me according to your word. And the angel departed from her. Now, prior to 1959, when pregnancy tests were finally refined, prior to 1959, having a baby was a little bit different than today. Now today, you suspect that perhaps you're pregnant, you run down to Walmart, you pay $7, you see if there's a little plus or minus sign. That was not the case back then. Today, you wait 14 to 20 weeks, you go see your doctor, they use a sonogram machine and they can tell you the gender of the baby. They can show you these 3D images. You can see, oh, it's got my nose. Those toes belong to my wife. I mean, you can see all of those things today. But back then, it just wasn't the case. Back then, things were a little more hidden, a little more mysterious, perhaps. 2,000 years ago, in a little town called Nazareth in Galilee, something strange happened. This girl, 13 to 15 years old, is going to be told that she will have the Messiah. And she will be with child, though she is a virgin. And all of this news is quite shocking to her. She's troubled. The angel appears. It says, and reread the text again this afternoon, it doesn't say he knocked on the door. It doesn't say he rang the doorbell. It says he appears. She's going about her business as normal young Jewish girl would be doing when all of a sudden an angel is there. She's terrified. What is going on? And he calms her down and says, you have been graced by God. You have found favor with God. Now, all of this happens on an obscure day when she had none of these events planned. And what I'd like to suggest to you this morning is that what happened on the day that this birth announcement came, what happened on that day was that God was revealing his will for Mary in a way that would completely transform her life. Imagine finding out God's will for your life in such a sudden and dramatic way. This morning, what I'd like to do is I'd like to look at how Mary responded to God's will for her life. And from that, I'd like to understand perhaps how we need to respond to God's will for our lives. I look across this room and I know some of your stories. Some of the ones you don't tell everybody, but some of the ones you've asked for prayer for. Some of the pains that you bring into this season, or some of the difficulty that has come your way this year. I want to ask you something. How are you dealing with God's will for your life? So what we're going to look at is we're going to look at how Mary responded to God's will and then why her response is so significant for us. So the first thing, how did Mary respond to God's will for her life? My friends, let us first just acknowledge this, that God's will for our life comes in various sizes and shapes. God's will for our life comes in a variety of flavors. God's will for our life sometimes comes wrapped with laughs and smiles. But other times it comes with eyes that are filled with tears. I mean, compare God's will for Abraham's life when he's 99 and finds out that Sarah's pregnant and they laugh and they rejoice in that day. But what about God's will for Job's life in Job chapter 1? You see, it comes in different packages, in different ways, sometimes with smiles and laughs, while other times with tears. Sometimes it seems to bring us pleasure, while other times it is extremely painful. And I would imagine that in this season, as you reflect on God's will for your life, some of you have deep joy welling up inside your heart, while others of you have deep pain. God's will for our lives comes in different forms and different fashions. But the question this morning is, how do we respond to it? God broke into the life of this young lady and said, here's my will for your life. You're going to give birth to the Messiah. It's going to be a virgin birth. It's going to transform everything. How did Mary respond? Let me just highlight three ways she responds. First, Mary got in her place. How did she respond to God's will? She got in her place. Notice verse number 38. Look what she says in verse 38. I am the servant of the Lord. Here's God. He's saying, here's my will for you. And how did she respond? She got in her place. What was her place? She's a servant. The Greek word there is doulos. I am a bond slave. Okay, God, this is what you want for me today? Okay, God, I'll do it. Now, some of us, you know, we can sit and think about this like, oh, yeah, okay, so she's going to have a baby, and that's God's will. And no, I mean, do you really get what's going on here? This was not something easy. This was not something normal. It wasn't something natural. This was going to be chaotic and crazy. And yet her response is, I am the servant of the Lord. In spite of all of her fears, all of her questions, she got in her place. Now, here's Mary, and she's afraid. God says, this is my will. She's afraid, but she didn't resist. Here's Mary. She's confused, but she doesn't protest. Servants aren't meant to rationalize. Servants aren't meant to see if all the logic holds up. Servants aren't meant to weigh the cost and benefit ratio. Servants aren't meant to think through contingencies. Servants are meant to obey. Sometimes I feel like here's our life, and God is saying, this is what I want you to do, or this is what I'm going to take you through, or here's a trial that I'm going to put in your path. And we try to rationalize it, and we try to, well, God, I don't know about this one. This doesn't seem to make any sense to me, or I don't understand this, or this is too hard, or wait, stop a second. Get in your place. He's the master. We're the servant. And when he delivers his will, we must respond by saying, I am the servant of the Lord. God, literally, here's what she's saying. God, if this is what you want, then do it. God, if this is your plan, then so be it. Let it be, just as you have said. I get this sense that Mary's communicating here, something like this. Anything you say, God, whatever you wish, God, your wish is my command. Yes, sir. Have any of you had any times in your life where all you could do was submit? Have any of you had any military experience? Few of you, right? I mean, so you're at basic or you're at OTS, officer training school. I went to seminary. I had two graduate degrees, and I walked onto Maxwell Air Force Base campus after paying the taxi cab driver $50. I was already like frustrated. $50, I could have walked. Fred Flintstone could have got here at $50. I'm pulling my thing, and I walk around this building, and people start yelling at me. Listen, they didn't teach us in seminary, like, this is how you respond when someone gets in your face and just yells at you. They didn't give us any training like that. I walk around this building, and without warning, they just started yelling at me, these drill sergeants. Cup your hands, cup your hands, cup your hands. You know, I've told some of you this story. I had no idea what it meant to cup my hands. So I drop my luggage, and I go like this. You know, like, I don't know. Why are you yelling at me? I don't know what I'm doing. You know, like, that's not how you cup your hands in the military. It was supposed to be like this. I was supposed to have like, I had no idea. They just yell at you. Listen, for the next 5 weeks, the only thing I could do was submit. Do you know your one answer? Yes, sir. Yes, sir, but what I think is no. Yes, sir, but that doesn't make any sense. No. It's yes, sir. Why? Well, because in that setting, you're the servant. They're the master. And it's interesting to me that some of these things, we can fall into those roles in these particular areas of our life, but we can't figure it out when it comes to God. My friends, if God tells you to do something, if God says, here's my will for your life, this is what I want, then what is our response? Our response needs to be, I am the bondslave of the Lord. Mary was humble in her station. She just recognized her place. Friends, there's nothing uglier than a person out of place, right? There's nothing uglier than to see a child commanding a parent or a student pretending to be the professor. Some of you are in classes, like the professor walks out and then one of the like button up, like nerd, starts being the student, you know, they're the professor going to tell you all what to do and you're like, sit down. There's nothing worse than someone who's out of place. My friends, it is an ugly thing when we are out of place with God. I am your servant. Let it be so. That's your will for my life. Then I will joyfully submit. Here's Mary, humble submission, ready service to the Lord. Perhaps one of the greatest hindrances in our lives of fulfilling God's will is our elevated opinion of ourselves. Some of us don't view ourselves as slaves. So instead, we argue with God, or we run from his commands, or we ignore him, or we just tune him out. But my friends, when God reveals his will to us, we must respond by getting in our place. Be a servant of the Lord. How else did Mary respond? Not only did she get in her place, but secondly, Mary yielded to God's plan without reservation or qualification. So God says, here's my will for your life. And Mary says, okay. She embraces it. No reservation, no qualification. What do I mean by those two words? Reservation means, well, are you sure, God? I mean, really? Is this? No reservation and no qualification. Not like, well, God, I'd be happy to do this as soon as I, or up to this extent, or no. When God gives his will, it's without reservation or qualification that we must yield to God. Where do we see this? Look at verse number 38. Verse number 38. This is what it says. It says, and Mary said, behold, I am the servant of the Lord. Let it be to me according to your word. Let it be to me just what you said, exactly what you designed. Let that be what happens. Here you have something more than just simple compliance. What you have here is Mary saying something to the effect of, let God do what he pleases, as he pleases, when he pleases. Let it be so with my life. So let me ask you something. Take your life. Take all of it. Take your time. Take your money. Take your relationships. Take your future. Take all of it. Now, are you willing to take that and say to God, God, do what you please, as you please, when you please, with all of this? I would submit to you that some of the great angst of our hearts, some of the deep discontentment of our hearts, is that we have not yielded to God's will without reservation or qualification. You see, when we hold on to our ideas and the way we think it should be, then we're troubled. When life just doesn't seem to be going the way we want, when the outcomes just don't seem to be what we expect, when we're not getting what we planned, oh, my friends, it's really not about our will. It's about His being done. Let it be to me according to your word. I was reading recently a short biography about a man named William Borden. Have any of you, perhaps you'll look in your refrigerator today and see if you have a jug of milk that says Borden on it, or you'll have a box of butter sticks and it says Borden Dairy on it. Borden is one of the largest dairies in the U.S., providing milk and butter and all these other products, right? Well, there was a man named William Borden. He was born at the end of the 1800s. He was the sole inheritor of all of the Borden Dairy wealth. Multimillionaire in the 1800s. I mean, he had a lot of money. He finishes, I mean, just to give you some scope and scale of what this dude had, on his 16th birthday, he graduated from high school, and his parents, the gift for him was a tour of the world. Some of you are hoping to get a shiny bicycle, you know. He got a tour of the world on his 16th birthday. But while he was traveling around the world, he wrote a letter home and said, because he sees all these people. He tells his family, I believe that God is calling me into missionary service. So here's this multimillionaire on his 16th birthday traveling the world. But when he sees the people of the world, he really believes that God's will for his life is to be a missionary. And so he writes that back to his family. Some of his friends find out and they mock him. You're going to throw your life away, they say. He wrote in his journal, no reserves. What did he mean by that? God can take all that I have and all that I am. I'm not going to reserve any for me, and he can spend it how he wishes. That was William Borden's heart. Well, he gets back after his 16th birthday, travel around the world. He begins college at Yale. While he's in college, he begins a prayer meeting in college. Just his heart is burdened for God's will for the nation. So he begins to pray. At his first meeting, he just had his roommate. A few months later, there's three people. By the end of his freshman year, there's 150 students from Yale that are gathering to pray. If you know anything about history, at the turn of the 1900s, 1905, you get the modernist debate. Yale was starting to go liberal. I mean, there's a lot of things. But he has 150 of these students praying. By the time he graduated, more than 1,000 out of the 1,300 student body were gathering to pray one day a week before. And it was started by William Borden, just praying for the nations, praying for God to work. Well, he finishes college. He goes to Princeton Seminary. He graduates from there, and people plead with him not to throw his life away in missionary service. Actually, he was offered some really great jobs, jobs that would provide lots of money. He could live on the wealth of his family. He could do a meaningful job, just stay here in the United States. But he believed that God's will for his life was to do missionary service, and he felt specifically burdened for the Muslims in China. He wrote in his journal, no retreats. Here he is. He finished graduate school. All these other calls. Change course. Settle in. Do the American dream thing. No retreats. I'm not turning back. I'm not holding on to anything. I have no reserves, no retreats. He ends up getting on a ship. He's heading towards China. He stops off in Egypt. He wanted to learn Arabic. Stops off in Egypt. While he's there, he's 25 years old. He gets spinal meningitis. Can't get him back across the ocean, and he dies. Well, that's depressing. Before he died, he wrote in his journal, no regrets. No regrets. No reserves, no retreats, no regrets. Why? Because he was doing God's will. You see, he was yielded to God's will. No qualifications, no reservations. Spend my life as you wish. That was Mary's heart in this situation. God is revealing his will in a way that seems crazy, odd, never before done, life-changing. And she says, let it be according to your word. Do what you wish. My friends, God wants all that we are and all that we have to be his. He wants it submitted to his will. You say, I don't know about that. My friends, read Romans chapter 12, verse 1. I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice. What more can you give? He wants it all. When God reveals his will, we need to get in our place, and then we need to yield to his plan without reservation or qualification. But here's third, and we see this in Mary's life. We need to trust God and his good purposes. We have to believe that what God wants for our life is what's best. I want to tell you something. One of the greatest crises of my life was that I did not believe that God's will for my life would bring any measure of satisfaction. What I thought is if I pursue my ideas, if I pursue my dreams, if I pursue my will, then I'm going to be happy. That's what I thought. And at the same time, I thought, if I yield to God, if I do what he wants, then I'm going to be sent over to Africa to eat bugs and live in a dirt hut with, I don't know, like slimy things between my toenails. I was just like, God's going to do something crazy to me and I don't want that. I want to have money and live my own life and do my own thing. One of the great crises of my life was coming to this conclusion that my satisfaction and God's glorification are not in conflict. Actually, I'm only satisfied when he is glorified with my life. I'm only satisfied. Some of you perhaps here have been seeking your own way. You've been doing your own thing. You've been on your own path. But my friends, you will not be satisfied. Just stop and ask yourself, am I really, truly satisfied? No, you're not, and I know you're not because you keep doing this cycle like this. Oh, I'm satisfied for a little while. It brings a little joy for a little while. It does this, and then you're back to zero again. And so you do the same thing over and over again. It's a vicious cycle, and you are not satisfied. My friends, when God displays his will for our lives, we must trust his good plan and his good purposes. That is what Mary does. I want to show you this in the passage here because there's an interesting contrast that takes place. Notice with me verse number 45. At this point, Mary has gone to visit her cousin Elizabeth. Elizabeth says to her, so Elizabeth says to Mary, verse 45, blessed is she who, what's the next word there? Believed that there would be fulfillment of what was spoken to her from the Lord. Elizabeth looks at Mary and says, blessed is she who has believed. Why is that a significant phrase? Well, Elizabeth is saying to Mary, you are blessed because you have trusted God's plan. You have had faith in what God is doing. And why is that significant with Elizabeth? Because if you go earlier in the chapter, and we don't have time to read the whole chapter, but if you go earlier in the chapter of Luke chapter 1, Elizabeth and her husband find out they're pregnant. But her husband, Zacharias, did not believe what God had said. Let me show it to you. If you look in Luke chapter 1, verse 20. Zacharias is mute. So here's Elizabeth saying, blessed are you because you believed God. Unlike him, the silent guy over here, the mime, who can't talk. Some of you wives would love to have that for a little while on your husband. Just... here he is, and notice verse number 20, here's why. Behold, you will be silent or mute and unable to speak until the day that these things take place because you did not believe my words, which were to be fulfilled in their time. So what's going on here? Elizabeth, she knows what happened to Zacharias, her husband. He did not believe when the Lord revealed his will. And so she looks at Mary and says, blessed are you because you did believe. You trusted God's good plan and God's good purpose for your life. And friends, it must be clear at this point that Mary did not have all the information and there were a ton of unknowns. And yet she still trusted God. So here's God. He wants you to do something in your life. He wants you to go somewhere. He wants you to start something or stop something. He wants you to be part of something or stop being a part of something. He wants you to go somewhere or not go somewhere. It's God's will for your life. You say, yeah, but I don't know all the details. I don't know how it's all going to turn out. I'm not sure. Stop. Trust God's good plan. Trust God's good purposes for your life. Believe him. Even if you don't have all the information, even if there are unknowns involved in this. How do we know that Mary really trusted God? Do you know what the fruit of trusting God is? The fruit of believing God, the fruit of trusting God is joy. Some of you want joy this holiday season? Don't bank on the fact that all your family's going to get along. Don't bank on the fact that you're going to get the great gift. Don't bank on that. If you really want some joy this season, believe God. The fruit of faith in God, belief in God, is joy. Do you know how that plays out with Mary? Here's Mary, she's believing into God, and she just breaks out into praise. Look at a few of the statements. It's called the Magnificat. You get this section, verses 46 through 55. I'll just highlight a few. Verse 46, Mary exclaims, my soul magnifies, or literally declares the greatness of, my soul magnifies the Lord. Verse 49, he who is mighty has done great things for me. Verse 51. He has shown strength with his arm. Verse 49. Holy is his name. How does Mary respond to God? She believes him. She trusts him. And what is the fruit of that? It's just joy. If you want joy this season, trust in God and his will for your life. Stop being consumed by worry and anxiety and fear. And start trusting God's plan. What do we see about Mary? How did she respond to the will of the Lord? She got in her place, right? She understood she was a servant. She yielded to God's plan without reservation or qualification. And she trusted God's good purposes. Now, why is this so significant? I mean, some of us maybe are like, well, that's admirable. But why is it significant to me? I mean, what's the point here? What do I need to understand out of this? Well, I want you to know that there were a great many obstacles that Mary had to overcome. So why was Mary's response so significant? What's interesting to me is that when God makes his will known to us, many times we're filled with excuses. Many times we're filled with exception clauses or reasons why we can't / won't do what he says. We come up with all the obstacles and reasons why it's probably not the best move, God. But that's not what Mary does. Mary accepts God's will, even though it was unexpected. God may break into your life and do something that you never planned on. But that's the way God works, isn't it? I mean, some of us, we're only comfortable with God's will as long as we've got it planned out. It's on my five-year goal list that God's going to work in this way. I've got it scheduled for tomorrow that God... No, my friends, God breaks into our life and reveals his will. And here's Mary. She's accepting the will of God, even though it's unexpected. Mary was going about her house, probably cleaning things up, cooking things, doing what every 13 to 15-year-old Jewish girl does, and God broke into her life. And he says, here's my will. Yeah, but I don't expect this. Wait, I wasn't ready for it. Let's try this again in 10 years. No. She just accepted it, even though it was unexpected. She cooperated with God's will. It's funny to me how she responds to this pregnancy. I worked at a pregnancy care center. For 5 years, I taught dad's classes. So I would go in there and teach classes to guys that were first-time dads. And they ranged anywhere from 14 to 38 years old. Just teach them, this is what it means to be a dad. This is how you do this, you know. And I saw the whole range of responses. How people respond to finding out that they're having a child. I mean, some people cry, and not with joy. Other people have fits of rage or anger. They can't believe it. Some people try to keep it a secret. Other people will even terminate it in order to continue with their own plans in life. But what's interesting about Mary is she just rejoices in God's will, even though this is completely unexpected. As I was working through this passage, thinking about the unexpected will of God, I thought about the fact that I am even here in Utah. Like, if you were to go back 5 years and look at Lucas's five-year plan, Utah was not on the list. I was in Texas. I'm pastoring a church down there. In 2010, in the fall, I decided, you know what our church needs? Our church needs, it needs a month of preaching on missions. So at the beginning of 2011, for a whole month, I preach on missions. Never expecting that God was gonna knock on my door and say, I want you to go to a place where the gospel is not so bright. And that wasn't even in my plan. But isn't that the way God works? I mean, think about your own life. Think about the way he's changed courses or interrupted your path. We need to receive God's will, even though sometimes it's unexpected. Not only that, we need to receive God's will, even if it seems impossible. Okay, so think about an angel. I mean, that's weird. Think about an angel telling you that you're going to have a child. I mean, if you're a woman, I mean, I'm not married. I know biology, you know. No, this whole thing seems impossible. It would be logically impossible, historically impossible, biologically impossible. This has never happened before. I know A plus B equals C. I understand the process, and this doesn't have that equation. It's impossible. And then look at verse 37. For nothing will be impossible with God. God reveals his will in our lives at times, and we say, that's impossible. If I do that, it's not going to work out. I don't understand. That doesn't make sense. Yeah, but God's will doesn't always make sense to us, and it's not constrained to our box of logic. We need to trust God's will, even if it seems impossible. I love this passage. If we had time, we'd unfold the whole of Luke 1. But the beginning of Luke chapter 1 talks about something that's improbable. It talks about something that's unusual. That's that an old woman gets pregnant. Her name is Elizabeth. And that's unusual and improbable. It did happen before. Remember Abraham and Sarah? So there at least was one case study from a long time before that happened. That doesn't normally happen. I mean, we don't expect that the senior citizens class is going to have a prayer request next week in community group that, hey, Bertha's pregnant. I mean, we just don't think that. That's unusual, improbable, all right? But the chapter progresses and it goes to something that is impossible and must only be done if it's supernatural. And that is, we're not just talking about an older woman in the natural course of marriage becoming pregnant. We're actually talking about a virgin becoming pregnant. It's seemingly impossible, and yet Mary responds to this with open arms. Verse 37, nothing will be impossible with God. The last thing we see here about the significance of Mary's response is that Mary, she didn't just receive God's will even though it was unexpected, or receive God's will even though it seemed impossible. What we find finally is that Mary received God's will even though it would cost her greatly. Sometimes I think we're willing to accept God's will as long as it advances our cause. God, I'll do whatever you want and become rich and live in a very nice house, and I'll do whatever you want and be very successful and famous. And I'll do whatever you want and have lots of friends. And I'll do whatever you want. And we have, like, as long as it leads in the direction that our life is going in, we're very happy to do God's will. It's kind of like your children. What do you mean my children? Kids, I want you to go eat some ice cream. Oh, very happily, Father. Very happily. Yes, sir. I'll go eat some ice cream. Kids, I want you to eat your broccoli. You know, they have lockjaw all of a sudden. Listen, my friends, we need to be willing to embrace God's will, even if it's going to cost us something. What could it have cost Mary? Well, how about her reputation to start with? Mary and Joseph get married. There's a baby that's born. People start doing the math. If people do the math today. You start doing the math. Well, wait. They've only been married for 6 months. They have a baby. Wait a second. Back it up. You know, I mean, just doesn't add up. Or she goes away for 3 months and visits Elizabeth, comes back. She's 3 months pregnant. It's a miracle. You know, I mean, no, people pretty much destroy her reputation. How do we know that? Well, you keep reading the Gospels. They will refer to Jesus with a slang idiom of the time, saying, oh, you're the son of that Mary. They referred to him as an illegitimate child of Mary, even in his grown ministry years. Her reputation was jeopardized by embracing God's will, and yet she was willing to embrace God's will. It cost her a reputation. It could have cost her relationship with Joseph. Do you remember Matthew chapter 1 from last week? What was Joseph's conclusion? It's kind of like this. We have a guy, he's an airman. He's engaged to a woman up at Hill Air Force Base. They get engaged. They're going to be married. He gets orders to go on a deployment. He goes away on a 6-month deployment. He comes back. She's pregnant. 6-month deployment, 3 months pregnant. It's a miracle. Is that what he's going to believe? What's he going to do about that? Well, probably what Joseph was going to do about it. He was going to put her away quietly and divorce her. Because clearly she did not value their betrothal. He's a just man, so he decides, I'm not going to make a big deal about it. But nonetheless, this relationship is done. Mary knew it could cost her a reputation and even cost her relationship, and yet she was willing to obey the will of the Lord. I want to ask you something. Are you willing to obey the will of the Lord, even though it may cost you a relationship? Boy, this is getting touchy. You mean I have to break up with that guy if it's the will of the Lord? I have to break up with that girl? I have to actually have a distance from some of these friends? You mean I can't do what they're doing if it's the will of the Lord? Are you willing to even risk relationships? Her reputation, her relationship, let me say this, it could have cost her her life. Do you realize that Mary embracing God's will in this sort of plan, a virgin pregnancy, could have cost her life? John chapter 8, what happens in John 8? A woman caught in adultery is brought before Jesus so that she might be stoned. Why? Well, because Deuteronomy 22:22, Leviticus chapter 20, verse 10, says this was a capital offense. Even her life could have been in jeopardy. And yet, she was willing to embrace the will of the Lord. She embraced God's will, even though it was unexpected, seemingly impossible, and could have cost her greatly. Are you willing to accept the will of the Lord? And we could end this morning, because we're nearly out of time, and say, let's be like Mary and embrace the will of the Lord. And I would suggest that we've fallen short, if that's our conclusion. If we end here, then we get an exemplar message in which we are supposed to be like Mary. I think it would be akin to me marching you down to the English Channel, telling you a story about a guy named John Erickson who swam across the English Channel 3 times. And 3 times, you can do it once. And then telling you, shoving you into the English Channel and saying, listen, he did it. Now you do it. Some of us are thinking, I have trouble swimming 22 meters, let alone 22 miles across the English Channel. It's not going to happen. You've never seen my doggy paddle. My friends, in like manner, here we have this amazing, exemplary story of a woman who submitted to the will of God for her life. And I say to you, now go submit to the will of God for your life. And you're like, yeah, but she crossed the English Channel. How am I supposed to cross the English Channel? I can't swim. It just doesn't work if we end the sermon this way. It leaves us perhaps feeling hopeless or helpless. We may know about her, but we may not be empowered to do what she does. We don't see ourselves in the picture of Mary's humility and obedience. And so I want to conclude by saying the story doesn't end with Mary. I want to highlight 2 words in verse 28 and 30. verse number 28, it says, "And he," meaning Gabriel, "came to her and said, 'Greetings, O favored one.'" Remember what I said that means? The word is charis, meaning grace. You that have been begraced. Notice verse 30. "The angel said to her, 'Do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found grace, favor with God.'" What we have in this context is a story about a woman named Mary who submitted to God's will, but at the root of it was the fact that she had been begraced by God. In this passage, I don't want you to walk away thinking that Mary possessed some sort of particular piety or holiness of life. She had some halo. She hovered 6 inches off the ground. She was a miraculous saint of some sort. No, because that puts it out of touch with us, and it's just not the truth of this passage. The fact of this passage is Mary had no special worthiness. Mary was begraced by God. She was favored upon, and therefore she responded with glad submission in spite of obstacles. This is a story about Mary who was begraced. She was begraced such that she gave birth to Jesus, the Son of God, who, my friends, longs to begrace each one of us. How is it that we will ever fulfill God's will? How is it that we will ever respond the right way to God's will? We need His grace. Mary was begraced to give birth to Jesus, and Jesus is the one who pours out grace upon us all. There's a passage in Philippians that summarizes this story. It's a command. It says, "Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling." It's akin to, go do the will of God and do it sacrificially and do it wholeheartedly and do it humbly. Go work it out. And if we end there, we're kind of like, man, I stink at working that out. No, but the next verse is this: "For it is God who works in you, both to will and to do His good pleasure." How is it that I will ever want to do God's will? How is it that I will ever succeed in accomplishing God's will? How is it that I can do that? Because God will work in you. He will begrace you. And so we get to this passage, and what we really find that we need is the same thing that Mary needed. What we really need to gaze upon is the same thing that Mary needed to gaze upon. And that is the one who has fullness of grace. Titus chapter 2 verse 11 says this: "The grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men." Who is that? It's Jesus. Such that John chapter 1 verse 16 says this: "From His fullness we have received grace upon grace." Jesus is the one who can begrace us such that we would fulfill His will for our lives. My friends, make no mistake. God is the battery in the flashlight. God is the gas in the engine. He is the wind in the sail. If we are ever going to shine brightly or run smoothly or sail fully, then it requires the good grace of God. And so I conclude with 2 Timothy 2:1, "You then, my child, be strengthened by the grace that is in Christ Jesus." The beauty of the Christmas story is that it drips with grace. Grace to accept God's will for our life.